I'm Tobin Heath.
And I'm Kristen Press.
We're World Cup champions, Olympians, and the hosts of The Recap Show.
Week in and week out, we sit down with sports legends, cultural icons, and global changemakers to talk everything from clutch games to causes that matter.
This is about creating the future of women's sports, a future that's honest, inclusive, and real.
Join us for our reimagined journey. Follow and listen to The Recap Show wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Rob O'Donnell Show on WILK News Radio, 103.1 FM, 910, 980 AM, or anywhere on that free Odyssey app. You can catch us anywhere you get your favorite podcasts. It is 510 here, 90 degrees on this Tuesday, August 12th, 2025. Just to move from the discussion of, I've heard the argument for over a year now. You know, the mayor of Scranton does not live in Scranton. Well, she definitely owns a house in Scranton. That I could confirm to you. Now, some people say, yes, she owns a house, but she doesn't actually live there. It's in, for appearance only. Well, I can't find another residence in Lackawanna County that neither her or her husband own, through a record search. So it's the only house that the two of them own. What I do find, though, is that the home, and I won't say where it is even though it's public record, but the home in Scranton owned by the mayor of Scranton and her husband does not have a homestead exemption, which I find odd. Could be a reason why or why not there's not a homestead exemption, but I don't understand why they would not have one. This was signed into law in 2006. Taxpayer Relief Act provides property tax reduction allocations to be distributed by the Commonwealth to each school district. Property tax reduction will be through the homestead or farmstead exclusion. Generally, most homeowners-occupied homes and farms are eligible for property tax reduction. Only a primary residence is eligible for property tax relief. Under the law, homestead is defined as a dwelling, including a parcel of land which the dwelling is located and the other improvement located on the parcel for which the following may apply. Basically, you have to live in the house. It's primarily used as the domicile of the owner, who is a natural person. The homestead for real property qualifying under this paragraph shall not include the land in which the dwelling is located on. The dwelling is a unit in a condominium as a term defined by section blah, 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 blah. Basically, you have a homestead if you live in a residential home. Homestead exemption on your taxes. That's usually recorded on the deed. I do not see one. So it's unusual that there's not a homestead exemption on the only home they own and live in. Again, could be a reason why. That's the only odd thing I can find. Other than that, it's the only home in their name that I could find in Lackawanna County. So until it's proven otherwise, she lives in Scranton. And again, the only anomaly that I could find is there's no homestead exemption, which may be a question to ask. Why don't you have the homestead exemption, since the homestead exemption, you must live in the home as your primary residence? So again, we'll move on from there because that really wasn't part of my discussion today. Nor do I, it's like them trying to block people who pay taxes in Scranton to not speaking at city council meetings, where both their solicitor or the president of the city council really don't know their own rules or what they follow. If you pay taxes in Scranton, you can speak at one of those meetings. That includes the payroll tax. So if you work in Scranton, even though you live maybe, say, in Clark Summit, you can go speak at a Scranton council meeting because you are taxed by them, and it is either a homeowner or taxpayer. So there you go. The more you know, right? Let me see where we were going to go from here. So there was this large meeting about the data centers at Valley View. Did anyone attend this meeting at Valley View? They said about 200 people showed up. So this was Monday, yesterday afternoon, state Senate hearing on the data center, where a panel of experts largely touted the benefits of the rapidly growing artificial intelligence-fueled industry rushing to build sprawling facilities throughout Northeast Pennsylvania. Now, the Valley View School District, that area that they cover is one of the more isolated areas. I believe four data centers are either in the works or planning stages for that area. But they addressed a large crowd yesterday. And again, if anyone went there to this meeting, let me know, because I'd love to hear your input. You could text it in if you want. And again, the most data centers proposal in Northeast Pennsylvania at five across its three towns. So five data centers are planned for the Valley View School District areas through the three towns that are around it. Panel of experts from across disciplines testified for over 3 hours, Senate Majority Policy Committee hearing, chaired by State Senator Rosemary Brown, State Senator Dave Argel, Rush Township, and Chairman of the Senate Majority Policy Committee, whose district encompasses Schuylkill, Carbon, and Southern Luzerne County. There are at least nine data center projects proposed across Lackawanna and Luzerne County, with three in Archibald, one projected in each proposed in Blakely, Jessup, and Clifton, Covington Townships, Hazel Township, Salem Township, tapping into the nuclear power plant at Sugarloaf Township. Argel and Brown, who requested the hearing and solicited written questions from constituents, opened with remarks emphasizing the need for information on data centers. The hearing was neither for nor against data centers, but rather an educational and uncovering updated factual information, Brown said. At the very core of this hearing is the question, why? Why do we need data centers, and why is it so pressing, Brown said, pointing to the use of data centers in everything from online shopping to Google searches to ChatGPT. The questions then jumps to, how do we provide and keep up with these demands? How do we take advantage of the economic benefits while ensuring our power grid, our water supply, and environment, health and safety, security, and citizens are always protected at the highest level? Now, there were some key points in there. Water supply and power grid. Those are the two at the top of that list that should be on everyone's mind when discussing these. One, they use a lot of liquid water, and sometimes they tap into groundwater to cool their facilities, and they use a ton of power. The power is more talked about. Water supply is not so much. Now, there are operations to where they use something like an antifreeze, which recirculates, so they're not using groundwater. They have their own fluid in the system. But then you have to realize, okay, what if there is some sort of breakdown? What if there is some sort of leak? Is this hazardous to the environment? What happens if this gets into groundwater or leaks out? Where do we stand there? Is there a retention built underneath it to capture anything that could possibly leak out of these places? There have been data centers to where they ran wells dry because they used so much water. The demand was to so much there. That's why a lot of our, most of our nuclear power plants are built on waterways, on rivers, on lakes. Because they on the ocean, because they do use a tremendous amount of water to flush the system for cooling. Right there, the two is. So after that, okay, how does this benefit the economy for local governments? How does this benefit the residents of the local governments? Aesthetic-wise, how is it going to change the dynamic of our communities? Is it going to be an eyesore? Is there going to be noise issues? What is it going to be when it gets to this sort of thing? So a lot of questions ahead, and they are rushing this. And that's not necessarily a bad thing if it's done properly. Not looking the other way because either you see dollar signs or you see jobs or you see – it needs to be looked at holistically. It needs to be looked at to say, is this going to be the next coal mining industry in Pennsylvania? Which, again, was a great thing, but it had its negative effects, and they are still being felt today. Or is this going to be the development of the next generation? And we're at that fork in the road. And to have meetings like this, and again, if anybody was there, let me know how it went. I believe it was recorded and it's out there. I have not had a chance to look at it, but I'm going to. Again, as someone who was immediately a proponent for these types of things, because I think they are needed, and I think, why not have them here? When I see some of the downfalls of it to where energy rates for surrounding communities sometimes suffer, to where they do go up, because with increased demand and not an increase of supply, prices go up. To make the power grid more robust going to these facilities, they do need to upgrade those systems. Well, why should we have to pay for that? That should be incorporated into the cost of building these companies, not say, well, we're going to improve the lines for everyone, so everyone's going to pay. No. No, we don't share in the cost for them and their data centers to make money. They're there to benefit us. They're there to make themselves an asset to the community, not only the tax base, but our power supply, our energy rates, jobs, and our economy. So those are the things that our elected leaders, and in this case, all the way down to the township levels, school district boards, counties, and our state government, and eventually federal government when it gets to nuclear power plants and power supplies and such like that. But some of the out-of-the-box ideas to where these companies now build their own power supply, well, that reduces demand for surrounding communities, which should in turn reduce costs. Make those power grids more reliable. Have separate entities. But again, when you look at water supplies and aquifers and groundwater and where we stand then, we have to make sure we're doing the right thing. So good they're having these meetings. Good they're having them here in our backyard, because there are a lot of planned facilities here, and it is the wave of the future. It's 5:21 here at WILK, time for 2020 traffic and weather together. Welcome back to the Rob O'Donnell Show on WILK News Radio, 5:26, 90 degrees outside. So, listen, I was told different things here, and it's funny how it comes around now. But a judge denies the Trump's Department of Justice request to unseal Ghislaine Maxwell's grand jury records. Now, I was told by Democrats that Trump was hiding this, and the Trump Department of Justice was covering up the Epstein case and files and everything else. But a Trump administration is facing another setback in attempting to curb backlash over the handling of the Jeffrey Epstein investigation, with another federal judge refusing to unseal pertinent grand jury transcripts. The request of the president, again, at the request of the president and the U.S. Department of Justice, filed a motion on July 18th to unseal grand jury material from the United States versus Epstein and the United States versus Maxwell. The latter case concerning Epstein's close associate, Ghislaine Maxwell, who aided and participated in Epstein's sex trafficking of minor girls. Invoking the special circumstances precedent, the DOJ made the request based on extensive public interest and the notion that the grand jury material contains critical pieces of important moment in our nation's history that are publicly unavailable. However, U.S. District Judge Paul Engelmeyer has denied the request to unseal grand jury records from the United States versus Maxwell, ruling that the Department of Justice legal argument fails at the threshold because a judicial review revealed that unsealing the grand jury material, and again, this is coming straight from the judge after judicial review, unsealing the grand jury material would not reveal new information of any consequence. The grand juries in the case were not used for investigative purposes. They did not hear testimony from any firsthand witnesses to any event at issue. They did not hear testimony from any victim, eyewitness, suspect, or even records of custodian. The grand juries met inside for the purpose of returning an indictment, the judge, an Obama appointee, said on Monday. Insofar, the motion to unseal implies that the grand jury material are an untaped mine load of underdisclosed information about Epstein or Maxwell or Confederates. They've derived are not that, he added. So Donald Trump, at the direction to the Department of Justice, attempted to have those files unsealed and a judge denied. But I've been told time and time again, and you see how they moved on from that real quick. by the way, where this that was last week's narrative, right? Where are the Epstein files? The Trump administration is hiding. They're running from the truth. No, they went to a court and tried to get them unsealed, and the judge said there's no information in here that's not already out there of consequence.
Hi, everybody. I'm Maury Povich. On my podcast, On Par with Maury Povich, I'm going to sit down with the icons, the stars, and the faces at the very center of today's big cultural moments. With everyone from comedians Josh Johnson, Dan Soder, Leanne Morgan, to newsmakers Don Lemon, Joy Reid, Aaron Parnas, and so many more. So join me for new episodes every week because nothing is off limits. Great conversations. They're always on par. Follow and listen to On Par with Maury Povich wherever you get your podcasts.
Quince. So just like all the dark rumors and the talk under the table where, oh, they have something on, there's something in those files on Trump, yeah, that were in the hands of the Biden Department of Justice for 4 years, and they did nothing with it, didn't weaponize it a single iota. Anyone believing that, I think that on-ramp to 81 will be open tomorrow. And we'll sell it to you if you'd like to buy that. Oh, it's getting tiring debunking all the nonsense. Come on. At least have a plan for the midterms where you're planning to do something better. Not just pointing fingers with other nonsense that has failed time and time again. It's 5:30 here at WILK. It's time for the news with Paul Michaels. Welcome back to the Rob O'Donnell Show on WILK News Radio, 535, 91 degrees here. So there was an incident out in the Philippines in disputed waters to where China, you know, says that it's their territorial waters, but it's not. And they harass Philippine and Taiwanese boats and fishermen, shooting water cannons at them, bullying them with the bigger warcraft. Well, there were two Chinese ships, a Chinese Coast Guard ship and a Chinese destroyer that were harassing a Philippine vessel. Well, it turned out that the Philippine vessel was faster, more agile. This is a Philippine Coast Guard near the Scarborough Shoal, which, again, China claims is their territorial water, but it's not. It's international waters. So what happens is this Philippine Coast Guard vessel outmaneuvered both of the Chinese Coast Guard vessel, and this is something out of Wile E. Coyote, if you watch the video. And the video's out there on social media. It was too fast, and as the Coast Guard vessel was trying to pull alongside of it or catch up to it, the larger Chinese Navy destroyer attempted to cut it off, but wasn't fast enough. And the Philippine Coast Guard vessel was able to get in front of it, causing the Chinese Coast Guard ship to slam right into the side of its own Navy ship, Chinese Navy ship, shearing off the entire front of the ship and doing damage along the entire side of the Chinese Navy hull. So both Chinese vehicles, a Coast Guard vessel and a Chinese warship, crashed into each other. Specifically, the Chinese Coast Guard vessel, cutter, slammed right into just off the bow on the left side of the Navy destroyer and causing damage down the complete side of it. But the entire front of the Chinese Coast Guard vessel was ripped off. Of course, the military hull has a stronger steel than the Coast Guard hull, and was the Chinese Coast Guard vessel was on the losing end of that crash. The Philippine Coast Guard vessel then spun around because both ships are now dead in the water because they both came to a halt. I would assume that based off the video, the Chinese Coast Guard vessel with its entire front missing had to do some severe damage control. And it says it's unknown the status of that vessel now, if they were able to shut all hatches to stop the entire vessel from flooding. The Philippine Coast Guard vessel, which was being harassed and pursued by these two ships, then goes over the radio and said, hey, Chinese warship and Chinese Coast Guard vessel that was trying to ram us, we have medical personnel on staff and supplies. We are here and standing by if you need our assistance. Now, obviously, the Chinese vessel or the Chinese Coast Guard vessel didn't respond to them, but it was basically a double middle finger to the Chinese warship and the Chinese Coast Guard vessel on, you know, see what happens when you F around. So crazy times out there. And there have been these close calls, not with our warships, but a lot of times with commercial vessels and such like that. They have blocked some of our Coast Guard. They have harassed United States Coast Guard vessels, but not have come this close to them and not have caused anything to this extent. But they parallel our warships and warn us that we're in restricted water, and we say we're from free navigation water. This is the United States Navy, and we're operating under international law within international waters under free navigation and such like that. They also will send up their fighters to harass our P-8s and our larger planes, but never challenge any of our fighters or anything like that. Some of them have gotten pretty dangerous. But for these two ships, both Chinese ships, a Coast Guard ship and a Navy destroyer from China, crashing into one another is the epitome of embarrassment. I would assume that now this is across the world. The Chinese government will tell its people that it's all fake propaganda and AI and quietly kill the commanders of the Navy ship and the Coast Guard cutter when they get back to port in China. But it was truly something out of Wile E. Coyote if you watch it, because the Philippine Coast Guard vessel was just too quick and just too maneuverable for them and had better seamanship. So bravo Zulu to you, the crew of the Philippine Coast Guard vessel in the Scarborough Shoals off of the Philippines. It's 5:40 here at WILK. Let's see. Welcome back to the Rob O'Donnell Show on WILK News Radio. 5:46, 89 degrees here as we start to wind things down. Well, this morning, 8 o'clock this morning to be exact, I was on Court TV again, opening statements with my friend Julie Grant, who's the host of Opening Statement on Court TV. And we were discussing the there's this case where there's this retired JAG officer, 13 years in the Navy, a lawyer, who allegedly, well, he's being accused of murdering and dismembering his wife in Georgia, about an hour outside of Savannah. Her body was found in multiple pieces over a 3-mile radius in some hunting ground in that area. And, you know, we were discussing, she had a body read expert on and myself to discuss the difference between how he was when he was first arrested in interrogation to where he was flinching and twitching and grabbing his jeans and wringing his fingers and his hands and like crunching down in a seat to where he was actually trying to hide almost or hide in the interrogation room to in the courtroom now where he's put his lawyer face on. He's dressed in his suit and tie. And sitting up there very attentively and just looking around like there's nothing going on, a totally different person. So, you know, she had us on today, and here's a little bit from that this morning before we close out the show.
We brought in this morning, we have Susan Constantine here, jury consultant and body language expert to help us out with that, and retired NYPD homicide detective and the host of the Rob O'Donnell Show. Rob O'Donnell is with us as well to analyze the interrogation of this guy. Good morning to you both. So Susan, let's start with the body language, please. We noticed him, and we're not quite sure if it's a tic, because we see a lot of blinking in the interrogation video, but we don't see this same tick in the courtroom. We just see it in the interrogation room. What does this tell you?
Okay, so I'm going to break this down for you. And I watched your show yesterday, and I was thinking, I need to be on the show to tell what this is going on.
Girl.
This is what we call an eye storm, okay? So we're seeing multiple things happen. We're seeing an eye tick, and we see that in where the even the cheek. cheek will even bop up, and sometimes you'll see it in his upper brow. So you'll see there is a tick, there is a spasm, but there's also eye blinking, rapid eye blinking, and then there are what we call eye shutters, where the eyes will close, hold for a minute, come back up. This is all caused by intense emotional distress. So why you don't see it beforehand is because he's not being interrogated. Here he's being interrogated. So that's what's creating what we call an eye storm.
This is really, really helpful, Susan. An eye storm, that's even better than an eye tick, right? Or a blinky. I kept calling him Blinky yesterday. I'm good Blinky Blinkerman, just won't stop with the blinking in the interrogation. He doesn't do it in the courtroom. So something must be stirring him up. A good detective in the interview room stirring him up. Rob O'Donnell, that's what you are, a sensational retired detective. We thank you for your service. And I want to show you a clip from that interrogation room. We'll get your thoughts on the other side.
Yes, this is why I switched to injection. So, that was
this morning on there. Of course, they put commercials in it as well. But that was Court TV opening statement. You can catch that on your cable channel. You can catch it online. And that clip is actually on YouTube. So it was a good time being on there and discussing it. It was a case that, you know, I had to start really diving into yesterday when they called me and asked me. You know, I don't really follow all the cases across the nation that are going on. But it was real interesting case to get into. The fact that there is a ton of circumstantial evidence, the fact that they found a knife where the body was discovered, pieces of the body was discovered. They found a bin near where the body was discovered that's believed to be the bin that carried the body parts into the woods. They have video of him buying a similar bin and a similar knife at a hardware store around the time that they dated the murder to, because, again, the body was found, you know, a while after the dismemberment, again, over a three-mile radius, because it was dismembered and spread around. The thing was, though, the forensic experts said that the dismemberment wasn't caused by the knife that was found at the scene and that was purchased. There were different tool markings. He or she believed that the body was dismembered by more of a power tool than a knife or a hand tool. So, again, a lot of circumstantial evidence, a lot of nothing but lies from the guy, to where he actually met another girl online while he was still with this wife. Ended up meeting her after the death, saying his wife died 2 years ago, and he used an assumed name, a different name. So it was interesting case to follow. And I believe today was the fifth day of the trial. It's still ongoing down in Georgia. And Court TV's covering it, so if you want to check it out, you know, go to Court TV or follow them on YouTube and follow that case. It's one of the many cases that they follow. And Julie Grant, an attorney, she hosts opening statements every morning from 8 to 9. Just a great show to be on, and, you know, she obviously, well, she says she really likes my input on the shows, and we're going to be on each other's show a little more moving forward. So some good stuff there. Something else that I did come across is the FAA has partnered with a college to train next generation air traffic controllers. Now, it says this is the first one in the nation. And if I was someone in Luzerne, Lackawanna Community College, or Johnson College, or one of our technical colleges around here, I would start reaching out to the Department of Transportation now. We have the assets here. We have the airport here. Let's get a program to train the next generation air traffic controllers right here in Northeast Pennsylvania using Avoca Airport as a training ground. Expand specialized training under the Enhanced Air Traffic Collegiate Training Initiative. The U.S. Department of Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy announced on Monday that the Federal Aviation Administration will be partnering with Nashua Community College. Our new partnership with Nashua Community College will help us continue to attract the best and brightest to fill our air traffic control towers, Duffy said in a statement. To all young Americans considering a career in this exciting field, your work will make flying safer and more efficient than ever. Monday's announcement of this new program to be announced this year in Duffy's initiative to build support for new generation of air traffic controller, according to the statement, invested in the next generation of air traffic controllers is critical to maintaining safety and efficiency in our national airspace, said the FAA administrator. Across the country, the FAA has only 9 programs that have been approved at 8 colleges and universities that offer or reflect the curriculum and technology being used. In New Hampshire, that's where this Nashua College is, this marks the first FAA-authorized training program. By expanding training opportunities through these programs, we're not only meeting today's staffing needs, we're building a resilient workforce ready to handle the challenges of tomorrow, Bedford said. Expanding opportunities for high-demand fields is essential to ensuring New Hampshire has a dependable pipeline of talent, New Hampshire Governor Kelly Ayotte said. During a supercharging hiring campaign, over 10,000 people applied for it before the close of March 17th. Out of that many applicants, only 8,300 made the testing phase. By the end of July, the FAA broke a record of having 550 students enrolled in the FAA Academy. That's the most they've had in agency history. In order to receive an official endorsement certificate, students must pass the air traffic skills assessment, meet the required medical and background clearance standards, and successfully demonstrate their skills and evaluate based on how well they perform. This is a new program, but it's not something we cannot do here. We have the airport here. We have a nice airport that they're investing in and expanding. We have the community colleges here that could easily institute this program and make Northeast Pennsylvania, make Lackawanna-Luzerne County, the next pipeline for FAA air traffic controllers. So if I was an administrator in Lackawanna-Luzerne County Community College, if I was at the airport a director, I would start calling meetings with all of you, getting what you need to do involved, get the Department of Transportation involved, and fast track this now. A new technical, on-the-ground, job-ready pipeline right here, right now. The amount of airports that are just around our 100-mile radius, Lehigh Airport, the airport right here in our backyard, Avoca. You have Stewart Airport. Right? There's a ton of airports where you could still live here that all need air traffic controllers. And again, you can go anywhere in the country. It's a great starting point for young people out of high school. Go get a 2-year degree. Get your certification in FAA, get your on-hands training here. This is something our area administrators need to pursue and need to pursue it now. This is a great avenue for our young men and women here that don't have to go to a dead-end university or college where they're going to get a degree in something that's not marketable at the end, not get woke indoctrination, get a real hands-on job where you're needed and with good pay and benefits. So anyone has any inklings in Luzerne or Lackawanna Community College and the airport here, they need to get on this and find out more about this program and get it started, because we could do this right here, right now, and be the next one that's being touted after this Nashua Community College and the airport there. It's 5:56 here at WILK. We'll be back to close it down in just a minute on this Tuesday, August 12th. Well, that's it for us today. Hopefully you enjoyed the show. Tomorrow's Wednesday, hump day already, and it's all downhill from there. Remember to get the best in if you're going to be over at the Rail Riders game. I believe that starts at about 6:30. I may see you there. Maybe I won't. Don't know how long I'm going to be there, but I'm going to check out a little bit of the game. But hopefully you enjoyed today's show. It was informative, and if not, we'll bring you more stuff tomorrow, and we'll try again harder, right? Obviously, we're not all going to agree on everything or anything, but that's okay. The fact that we're talking and listening is what's important here, because we do need to move forward as a nation. I know it's hard sometimes. Things are hard. Life is hard. But if it was easy, we wouldn't grow as a people, right? It's 88 degrees now as we close it down. God bless. Be safe. We will see you tomorrow.
Sometimes historic events suck. But what shouldn't suck is learning about history. I do that through storytelling. History That Doesn't Suck is a chart-topping history-telling podcast chronicling the epic story of America decade by decade from the 18th century to the 20th. Original music and immersive sound design accompany us on our storytelling journey. Listen to and follow History That Doesn't Suck, an Odyssey podcast, available now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.